This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about a conflict happening within Major League Baseball. Owners and players have largely stopped communicating and are in the process of negotiating different elements of the sport, from pay structure to the rules of the game. We're joined now by Harry Marino, Executive Director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers. Welcome back, Harry.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I want to get started just the basics of what this lockout is, because I think there's so much going on in sporting. You know, there's the Olympics, there was the Super Bowl. Some people might not know what's going on. What is the lockout and what does it mean in particular right now?
So right now, Major League Baseball is basically in a standstill. And the reason is the league operates under a collective bargaining agreement between the owners and the Major League Baseball Players Association, the union representing the players. And that agreement expires every so often. And it expired back in November of 2021 after a five-year term. And the two sides were not able to come to an agreement, back in November on a new deal. And at that point, the owners made a decision, which they did not have to make, to basically shut down the industry and to lock the players out. So to literally prevent the players from entering team facilities and to bring the industry to a halt, to a standstill. So that's where we sit right now. Right now is the time that Major League players otherwise would be showing up in Florida and Arizona for annual spring training activities to get ready for the season. But the two sides don't have a new deal. The owners are continuing to institute that lockout of Major League players. And so spring training is not starting on time at this point, and we don't know when the season will begin.
That's interesting. I mean, is that legally, are they allowed to do that to their players? I'm just thinking of other bargaining agreements where, you know, you just kind of keep operating while negotiations continue.
Yeah, so certainly the owners have the option to continue to bargain, under the old agreement, but they chose not to do that in order to put pressure on the players. So, you know, the strike is the pressure, economic pressure point under the National Labor Relations Act that unions can institute. And the lockout is sort of its counterpart from the management side. So certainly there's nothing to prevent the owners from negotiating and letting the season start and letting that operate in the background. They've chosen not to do that in the hopes that will put more pressure on the players to come to an agreement that's more favorable to the owners. So it's really an opportunity to use leverage and to put pressure on the players with respect to the new deal. And certainly, you know, now we have spring training games that are going to be missed here in a couple weeks. And then once you get to the end of March, actual regular season games that might be missed. And as a result, paychecks that players will miss. So that's, you know, they see that on the ownership side as an effective form of leverage. Unfortunately, it comes at the expense of the game and of the fans who want to go out and watch, watch our national pastime. They don't get to do that as long as the lockout is ongoing.
Is there any pressure from venues to push these owners to drop this and to bargain?
So certainly, you know, fans at this point in time and out the outside, you know, sort of third parties are very much on the player side. And historically, there have been work stoppages in baseball where public opinion has been more even or has been more on the side of the owners. This time around, it seems that public opinion is very much on the side of the players and that the fans are very much sort of on the side of the players here and the public is very much on the side of the players. So, I think the owners are feeling some pressure to get a deal done, to not miss games and to make this sort of, you know, see itself to a resolution as quickly as possible. But from a legal standpoint, you know, they are within their rights to do what they're doing. They're playing hardball and there doesn't seem to be any inclination to stop doing that at this point, at least, you know, from the outside, from what we've seen.
Is this common every couple years that they get to this point, or is it unusual?
So It's been quite some time since there's been a work stoppage in baseball. The last one was in 1994-1995. So it's been, you know, going on almost 30 years since there's been a work stoppage in baseball. Prior to that, work stoppages in baseball were much more frequent. I think there were about 8 or 10 of them in the sort of 10, 15, 20 years before the 94-95 strike. So it's not common anymore. Certainly this is a unique moment in the labor history of baseball. And it's something that certainly all of the players and most of, you know, the leadership on both sides of the aisle have not participated in before. So it is in many ways uncharted territory here that we're wading into.
Let's talk about what the disagreement on the agreement is. Instead of renewing what they had, it sounds like they want some changes. What are those changes?
So the fundamental sort of disagreement at this point is about when in players' careers they should get paid. And to understand what I mean by that, I think it's helpful to sort of go back in time a little bit and understand the history here of how baseball players are compensated and how skewed in favor of the owners that has been historically. So, you know, from professional baseball has been played really since the mid to late 1800s in this country. And for the better part of a century, up until around, the mid-1970s, players operated under what was known as a reserve clause. And what the reserve clause is really simple. Players would sign a contract with the team, and the contract would have a clause in it that said that it was automatically renewed for another year at the end in perpetuity. So what that meant was once a player signed with the team, they were stuck with that team for the next year, and then the next year, and the next year, and the next year, and so on, so that there was no opportunity for the player to leave and go seek out a better deal with a different team. So, you know, in other words, there was no actual market for professional baseball players. You signed with one team, you were stuck with that team forever. As you can imagine, that depressed salaries very considerably because there was no competition for the services of baseball players. Now, fast forward to the 1970s, that's the way it had been for about 100 years. At that point, Marvin Miller, the first executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association, the union, along with two of the players, challenged that reserve clause, and an arbitrator said, and the reasoning here is sort of a rabbit hole that we don't need to go down, but the bottom line is, said that the reserve clause was not legal. And so after a year of playing under the reserve of one team, a player could become a free agent. So that threatened to upend the entire system of compensation for professional baseball players, because now guys had no market for their services. They were suddenly going to be able to go to any team and go to the highest bidder the next season. So Major League Baseball was threatened by that. They didn't like the idea of how quickly the wages could skyrocket, which, by the way, they did anyway, just by having any kind of a free market. And they instituted this system where players are under contract for 6 years with their major league team and then become a free agent and can go to any team and get whatever payment that other team is willing to give them. So right now, that's the system that operates in baseball, this 6 years and then you become a free agent. What has changed in recent years is teams have stopped paying players after their sixth year in the major leagues for the most part. Very few players, once they get to free agency, are signed with a team at this point because teams have realized it's easier to just pay players who are on those first 6 years because the control of the team means that the compensation is much lower there. So there's this system that has been in place for a long time that isn't really working anymore for players because guys are not getting paid after they get to that sixth year and actual free agency. Teams are just sort of refusing to sign those guys and are instead signing cost-controlled players who are earlier in their careers. And so that's kind of what they're fighting about now is how do we reshape this system that operated a certain way for the last 50 years in a way that's more fair to players and ensures that players will actually get compensated in a way that is commensurate with the value they're providing to teams. It's pretty, you know, it's technical stuff, but it has a big practical impact, and players are pretty upset about it.
It sounds like a lot of bargaining agreements I've heard of where, you know, it's as time goes by, you notice they want to bring in younger employees that are going to have lower salaries and then kind of edge the folks that have been there for a while out. Is there any indication that there could be a solution on the horizon?
You know, it's hard to say from the outside. Obviously, I'm not sitting at the table, so I don't know exactly what is being sort of offered back and forth between the teams. From what's being reported out, it seems that the owners are very committed to the same system, and the players are very committed to change. And so there seem to be at a real standstill right now where nobody is willing to budge. And, you know, it doesn't seem that there's sort of a, you know, an agreement that's right around the corner or right on the horizon. It doesn't seem that way at this point. But, you know, we're going to have to wait and see how the next weeks and play out, because as I said, once we get up to the season actually getting started, then there's going to be more pressure on both sides to come to a deal. So they're very far away from each other, it seems, right now. But that could change relatively quickly as the season becomes more and more imminent and then games start to be missed.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of moments. We're talking about the MLB lockout, and we're also going to get some updates on the working conditions for minor league players. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about the partial shutdown of Major League Baseball as owners and players are negotiating different aspects of the game, from player pay to how teams are run. To learn more, we're joined again by Harry Marino, Executive Director of Advocates for Minor Leaguers. Harry, before the break, we kind of touched upon, I'm trying to remember now what we mentioned, sort of the future and how things look. One thing that I was wondering in terms of major league and lockouts and stuff, do owners have now the power over players? Like, are they with the ball in their court?
So, look, at this point, I think it's important to remember that players are ultimately the power source in the game, right? Fans come out to watch players, the greatest players in the world, play baseball. They don't come out to the field to watch the owners own the team, right? With no players, there's no game. So at the end of the day, the owners have a lot of resources and money at their disposal, but the ultimate power source in the game are the players. And I don't think anything can ever change that. I mean, the owners facilitate sort of the way that the game operates, but the reality is the main stakeholders here are the fans and the players. Fans come out to watch players play, and the players play for the entertainment of the fans. The owners provide the capital. I'm not suggesting that they have no value in this, but ultimately it's the players that that are where the power in the game is. So I don't think anything can change that. I think the owners are trying to have a stare down with the players, but as long as the players stay united in their attempt to be treated fairly, I don't think anything can sort of strip that power away from them.
Something that that fascinated me was what you mentioned earlier about how after 6 years they become free agents in Major League Baseball. I had no idea. So it's interesting, because I think what we hear often is like, this person signed a contract, you know, $200 million or like some huge amount. And so it just is an assumption that these players haven't made. And so, yeah, well, you got 6 years. Maybe you made several hundred million dollars.
Right. And that's not the way that it works. I mean, just to be very clear about the way the system works, A player gets drafted by a major league team. He then signs a minor league contract. The minor league contract is 7 years in length. For the duration of that contract, players are paid between $5,000 and $15,000 a year. That's it. Then a small percentage, about 1 in 10 players make it to the who are drafted, make it to the major leagues, where they are on the major league minimum salary, which is quite a bit higher. It's about $500,000, $600,000 per year, somewhere in there, depending on the year, for the first 3 years of their career. And then from years 3 through 6, they're able to go to salary arbitration, where they make something more than the minimum, but something far less than what they're actually entitled to on an open market. And the average major league player, again, only 1 in 10 players even makes it to the major leagues at all. And then the average major league career is just about at that 3 year mark. So very few guys are making it even to arbitration, where they get some percentage of what they're entitled to on an open market. And then a minuscule percentage of players actually make it to free agency. And those are the very few players who get the multi, you know, $100 million contracts, and they're very well known, and those are the ones that get a lot of visibility. And as a result, there's a misunderstanding and a misconception about the way that players are compensated. The structure pays quite handsomely the very, very, very few players who are able to make it all the way through the minor leagues and then to 6+ years of major league service time. But everyone else, the 99% of professional baseball players, are undercompensated relative to their actual fair market value because of the way this unique salary structure has been set up over the years.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, it kind of reminds me of the journalism industry, where it's like so many people are in the field, you know, barely making ends meet. And then people see folks that are high up there and assume that everyone's living this very VIP life. And that's not the case at all. if you're listening right now and you have a question or comment on the topic, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That number again is 866-476-3881. We have a question from Chris on Facebook, who asks, is there any sense that Commissioner Manfred's job is in any jeopardy? Now, this is a little inside baseball, pun intended here. Can you explain this to me?
So Rob Manfred is the commissioner of baseball. He has been for about 7 or 8 years at this point. Before that, he was a lawyer, first outside counsel for the league, and then in-house counsel at the league for a number of years. And he worked his way up through the system and now is the commissioner. You know, there's a misconception that the commissioner of a sports league is this neutral third party, this sort of, you know, arbiter that stands above the game, neither on the owner side or on the player side, just looking out for the best interests of the game. That's simply not true. The reality is that the commissioner serves at the pleasure of the 30 owners and is the representative of those owners. So, Rob Manfred, and I think if he were sitting here, would say the same thing, really is operating at the behest of the 30 owners, and is not sort of set out to is not setting out to look out for sort of the best interest of the game. That's not his job description. So, you know, I think if his job description were to look out for the best interest of the game, then it might be a little bit different than his potentially his job could be in jeopardy, just based upon a lot of the things that have gone on recently and how unhappy a lot of fans are with the current state of the game and this current work stoppage, et cetera, et cetera. But because he ultimately is more or less just the lawyer for the owners, I don't believe at this point that there's any understanding that his job is in jeopardy. I think he's playing hardball on behalf of the owners, and that's sort of what they expect him to do. Having said that, if a significant number of games are missed, and owners start to lose money because the players are stronger than and more unified than they thought, that could change. Maybe he could lose some favor with the owners. I think it's too soon to say that at this point.
What would happen if this season were delayed because the lockout is continuing, aside from fans not being able to watch baseball? But what kind of ripple effect could it have?
Well, look, I think that there are a lot of different entertainment sources right now available to people, whether it's other sports, whether it's, you know, streaming stuff, whatever the case may be. So I think there's a real risk for the owners who own these baseball teams, which are tremendously valuable. I mean, the average team is valued at about $2 billion, somewhere around there, that if they, you know, play too much of hardball with the players and don't, you know, compensate players fairly in a manner commensurate with the actual value that they're providing, and they miss games as a result, that fans could start to turn to do other things rather than watch baseball and find out that they actually like doing those other things. And, you know, maybe they don't come back later this season when baseball comes back. So ultimately, you know, the value of these franchises is based upon the fans. And I think the owners would do well to remember that, because if they turn off the fans, you know, it's going to be potentially hard to win some of them back. And I think that's the ripple effect. That's the greatest risk to the game, is just forcing people to find other ways to be entertained during those spring and summer nights that they might have otherwise gone out to the ballpark.
Does the lockout have any impact on minor league players?
So it doesn't have a tremendous direct impact on minor league players, because minor league players are not part of the major league union. So the Major League Players Association represents everyone on what's known as the 40-man roster. And that is, you know, there's 26 active members of the Major League roster, and then some guys who are on the injured or restricted list, and then some guys in the minor leagues who are on a Major League contract and part of the union. But the vast majority of minor league players are not on that 40-man roster, and therefore are not a part of the Major League Baseball Players Association. As a result, they are not a part of this dispute. They're not a part of this lockout. They're not locked out. A lot of them are currently operating as business as usual. They're at their spring training facilities in Florida or Arizona, and they are starting to prepare for the season themselves. So, you know, obviously minor league players are part of the industry and therefore kind of have an eye on this, and certainly are paying attention to it. But there's no expectation that the day-to-day existence of minor leaguers will be impacted or altered by the major league lockout.
I do want to talk a little bit more about minor leaguers. I know last time you were on the show, we were joined by minor leaguer Kieran Lovegrove, and we talked about the working conditions for minor league players. I want to take a listen real quick to a clip from him.
It's a complete external locus of control for the most part. You know, and I think that that has led to a bit of a mental health crisis in baseball, where these players who are extremely talented and high level individuals are not being treated with nearly the care and respect that they deserve for the hours and the, you know, risk that they take upon their body to try and play this game at this elite echelon of play.
Harry, how much of a problem is mental health for players right now? Is that still an issue that's being talked about?
Yeah, certainly. Look, I don't think there's been any difference in terms of that issue from the time you heard from Kieran. You know, mental health issues abound in our society more largely at this point. I think there's a sort of a increased awareness around that. And certainly there's an understanding that the conditions in minor league baseball are certainly not going to alleviate those problems, and in many cases may even, you know, exacerbate them. And the reason is really simple. Minor league players are making, as we talked about last time, you know, between $5,000 and $15,000 a year, depending on level. They, you know, often in the past have struggled with housing and food insecurity. They only get paid during the regular season and the playoffs. So right now we have guys who've been under contract for years with their minor league team, with the major league team assigned to the minor leagues, and they haven't received a paycheck since September, as we sit here on February 14th, and they won't receive one until April. So guys have gone months and months without a paycheck, all the while performing services, training every day, working out, throwing, hitting, preparing for the season without pay. And they've had to do other things to make ends meet, whether it's, you know, being a bartender, a cook, moving furniture, driving for Uber, driving for Lyft. You know, a lot of these guys have worked, you know, 12, 14, 16 hour days every day in the off season just to try to make ends meet and keep a roof over their head. And those kinds of conditions and those kinds of stressors certainly bring out a lot of underlying conditions and create problems. So, you know, when you don't, you know, major league teams, unfortunately, don't treat minor league players like human beings. They treat them like commodities. And as a result, there's a real human cost to that, which includes, you know, a mental health cost.
You mentioned that minor leaguers haven't been paid since September. Can you refresh my memory on that, or if you've mentioned it and I just forgot?
Yeah, so the way that the uniform player contract that every minor league player signs works is players are only paid during the championship playing season, which is essentially the regular season, which starts in April, and the playoffs. So from April to September, players receive a paycheck every 2 weeks, right? And that paycheck is, the amount is between $400 and $700 a week, depending on what level of the minor leagues the player plays at. So for the year, you know, that's only, you know, if you're in short season, that can be about $4,800 for the whole year. If you're at AAA, the highest level of the minor leagues, that could be about $15,400 a year. And everyone else is making somewhere in between. Then, you know, September hits, the season ends, and guys leave, you know, their city where they've been playing in the minor leagues, and they go home, and they're still under contract at that point. Their contract requires them to perform services. It literally says that they have to perform services on a calendar year basis, even though they only receive salary payments during the championship playing season. So guys then go home, and they work out hours a day for the entirety of the offseason, preparing for the next season, but they don't receive any paychecks for that entire time. And then they even go to spring training, which is what's happening right about now with guys reporting for 4 to 6 weeks in Florida or Arizona, where they're working out in an organized way with their team under instruction of the team every day, and they don't receive any payment for that either. So yeah, it's the September until April period that guys go without any kind of a paycheck. It's, you know, just goes without saying, but it's really fundamentally unfair, and it creates a lot of hardship for players who are struggling to make ends meet while providing valuable services to multi-billion dollar employers.
Is there a union for minor league players?
There is not, and that's one of the biggest reasons why minor league players continue to be exploited, is the lack of a union. So, you know, to go back in history, you know, in 1968, when Marvin Miller, as I referenced earlier, the first executive director of the Major League Union, helped players to negotiate the first ever Major League player collective bargaining agreement, the minimum salary was raised from $6,000 a year to $10,000 a year. So back then, Major League players were essentially treated the way minor league players are today. They had to work second jobs. They were making very little money. Then they unionized, and the Major League Union became one of the most powerful unions, not only in sports, but in the entire country, which led to the, you know, tremendous salary increases that we've seen over the last 50 years. Well, minor league players are in many ways like Major League players in the years before the MLBPA changed things forever at the Major League level. So it's that lack of a union. I think when you compare Major Leaguers pre-union to minor leaguers today, there's so many similarities. It becomes pretty clear that that's a huge difference maker for these guys, the lack of a seat at the table and the lack of collective bargaining rights.
Before we jump to break, how supportive have Major League players been so far with the issues faced by minor leaguers and vice versa?
Yeah, so look, Major League players, almost without exception, went through the minor leagues themselves. And so they, you know, remember what it was like. And many of those guys have been extremely supportive of minor leaguers as minor league players have begun to speak out more about their working conditions over the last couple of years. You have guys like David Price and Ryan Zimmerman, guys who went into their own pocket to pay minor leaguers directly during the pandemic because they knew those guys were struggling to make ends meet. So, you know, that's one example. Last year, we had a number of players at the major league level, Trey Mancini, Andrew McCutchen, Jose Ramirez, some really big name players take the field wearing wristbands and said, advocates for minor leaguers on one side and hashtag fairball on the other. So major league players certainly have shown, especially over the last couple of years, that they are attuned to the issues facing minor leaguers, that they support minor leaguers. You know, this growing awareness of the mistreatment of minor leaguers is sort of a newer issue that fans and the public are sort of paying attention to. And as that happens, I expect only more and more major league players to continue to get involved because, as I said, they lived it.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. I'm Miriam Sobe. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing the current Major League Baseball lockout and getting some updates on changes to working conditions for minor league players with Harry Marino, Executive Director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers. And if you have any questions or comments for our guest today, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We have a question from Joel on Facebook who asks, what other benefits do players have if they make it to MLB? Insurance, pension, or 401k? And are players considered contract laborer or employees?
So players are considered employees at both the minor league and the major league levels. And at the major league level, and players, I should also say, have health insurance as well. At the major league level, one of the major things that the union fought for back in, you know, the 1960s and 70s, in the early stages, was the pension. That was sort of the major issue that actually players organized around when they first created the Major League Baseball Players Association. And so certainly that is, you know, another thing that players benefit from today. I would say the other major benefit that, it's not a benefit because players are not getting it from the owner, from the owners, but it's just something to know, is that major league players can profit off their name, image, and likeness. And what the major league union does is group those name, image, and likeness rights and then distribute those out to various parties who want to, broadcast the players in one form or another, whether it's video games or, you know, trading cards or whatever it may be. Minor league players do not have those same image and likeness rights. So when minor league players sign the uniform player contract, they actually sign away those rights to their name, image, and likeness to the team. And so, for instance, you know, minor league players are in some video games these days. They don't see any payment for that at all because they've signed away those rights to the major league team. So just an interesting and unfortunate example of the lack of a union and the way that it creates this dichotomy between major league players and minor league players to the detriment of minor leaguers.
Yeah. I mean, just thinking about that, I mean, it would sound to the average person like myself that's looking at this from the outside that it's taking advantage of folks by making them sign away their rights and then they could have potentially had some extra income.
Absolutely. The uniform player contract is borderline unconscionable. I mean, that's the bottom line. There's no doubt that any kind of a fair contract would compensate players in a manner that's somewhat commensurate, at least, with the value they're providing. And so players would certainly be making a livable annual salary as a minor league player. And players would be able to profit off, in some capacity, their name, image, and likeness. Unfortunately, that's not the case today. And part of what our organization, Advocates for Minor Leaguers, is doing is bringing players together to speak up about these issues and to force the league's hand to make some changes, because the power dynamics have been so one-sided for so long that minor league players have really been, you know, incredibly taken advantage of in a way that I think most baseball fans don't know about. But as they find out about it, they're deeply, deeply disturbed by. So it's been good to see the fans are on the side of the players, and we just need to continue to raise awareness about how players are actually treated, because if we do so, I'm confident that the owners will continue to make concessions and will, improve the treatment of minor leaguers going forward.
Last year, Major League Baseball announced they would require teams to provide housing for their minor league players. Has that been resolved, and how bad was the housing issue?
Yeah, so that's a perfect example of kind of what I was just talking about players coming together and forcing the league to make some changes and in doing so to shift the power dynamic a little bit. So, you know, if you go back in time, minor league players traditionally have lived six guys to a two-bedroom apartment during the season on air mattresses. That's really the stereotypical minor league housing situation for many, many years. Any player who wanted to live better than that would have to pay more than their monthly paycheck to do so. This past year, we started to talk to players about what they'd like to see change in the minor leagues, and housing was really the first issue that came to mind for most guys. And so what we were able to do was bring players together to just raise awareness about housing. And that took the form of, you know, social media tweets and posts about revealing the reality of how players were living, showing photos of their living arrangements, doing interviews with various reporters in the baseball media and the general media about minor league housing conditions. And over the course of last summer, as awareness was being sort of raised among fans, the league started to feel some pressure. And then on September 18th, our organization, Advocates for Minor Leaguers, hosted a fan appreciation day at about 10 stadiums around the country, where we handed out those Fairball wristbands I was referring to earlier and some literature explaining the way that players are actually treated, which we found most fans didn't know about as they were coming in to watch those players play. And that same day, a number of players took the field in Brooklyn, New York, wearing the Fairball wristbands, minor league players, in what was really the first minor league player on-field demonstration of any kind. And just 3 days later, the owners voted to change the minor league housing policy for this 2022 season going forward and to provide free furnished housing to players. So you can really see there how when players come together and organize around an issue and raise awareness about an issue, it's really the only way to change that power dynamic and to get wins for minor leaguers and to push the owners into some improvements. And housing was sort of the first arena in which that happened this past year.
Were you surprised to see them provide the housing?
So I think how quickly it happened was really a testament to how much power players have that's untapped when they work together, right? Owners understand that, like major league players, minor league players are the lifeblood of the game. And a bunch of disgruntled players who are going to be your future major leaguers and who are currently providing value to you is not good from a business standpoint. And so I think when players spoke up, the owners listened and they said, look, this is something we've gotten away with for a long time, but it doesn't make a lot of sense. Players are very disenchanted by it. They're very upset about it. They're making that known. It's making us look bad in the public. It doesn't make sense from a player development standpoint, because we should want our players well-rested to perform at their best. So it's time to fix it. And I think, you know, as we move forward, that we can use that blueprint to continue to organize players around common sense issues that should be changed, like a livable annual salary. So guys don't have to do those second, third jobs I was mentioning earlier. You know, spring training pay. Guys should not be working for weeks without pay in Florida and Arizona here, you know, at the end of February and March. These are things that if players put their voices together and speak up and make fans aware of what's going on, I believe that the owners will have to listen, because at the end of the day, they're still making tons and tons and tons of money off of these guys and are paying them just a fraction of what they're actually worth, whether they provide them free housing, whether they provide them spring training pay, a livable annual salary, all the above. They will still be making a killing on minor league players. And these are businessmen, and you know they're going to be willing to make those concessions up to a point. And we are far away from that point where it will no longer make sense to make those concessions, because we're still so far away from minor league players being treated in a way that's at all consistent with the value that they're really providing to their teams.
Is there any concern that this might just be the offer, like we'll cover the housing and we'll come back to you in several more years on the other topics that you're concerned about?
Well, I think that's really going to be up to minor league players, right? I think if minor league players are content with housing, then that is what owners will do. But if players and supported by the fans say, this isn't enough, we're still entitled to more, and you're not going to just appease us and buy us off with, you know, with this housing change, then I think that there will be further concessions down the line. As I said, in the context of the major leaguers, baseball players are the lifeblood of the game. Those are the people that the fans come out to watch. Players are the talent. They're providing the labor. They are the product. And so if minor league players want more than housing, minor league players are going to get more than housing. I truly believe that. And I believe further, based upon our conversations with players and my personal conversations with players, that players do want far more than housing. And they know that they're entitled to well, well more than they're getting right now. And I think there's been an awakening where guys are saying, you know, this is ridiculous. I shouldn't be struggling to make ends meet. I'm one of, you know, the top 0.1% of, you know, baseball players in the world. And I'm working for, and I'm an integral part of, an entity that's worth multiple $1 billion based upon, in large part, my labor. And I shouldn't be making $8,000 a year. And the old way of doing things and the old mindset, I think, has gone out the window in large part. So, you know, if I, you know, I'll wait and see what actually happens. But if I'm predicting, I would say, no, housing is not going to be the end of the road in terms of the improvements.
I want to go back a little bit to Major League Baseball, the lockout. I think you mentioned the last one before this was 94 or so. How long did that take to resolve? And is this one looking to be longer or shorter than that?
So in 1994, it was actually a strike and not a lockout. So what happened was about midway through the season, the players went on strike and walked out, and the end of the season was missed, as was the World Series. It was a canceled World Series. The strike lasted throughout the offseason and into the beginning part of the following season, the 1995 season. So it was a long one. And, you know, it was really, it was a very challenging moment for the game in terms of the fans, but it was necessary from the players' perspective to get what they, you know, what they needed to fight for in terms of fair treatment. And this time around, it's hard to predict where it will go. It's a lockout and not a strike. It's a different point in the season. I don't expect that the entire season and the World Series will be missed, but that's ultimately going to be up to the owners at this point, who have the ability to lift the lockout and let guys go play right now and negotiate the deal behind closed doors. They've chosen not to do that. They want to play hardball. So any games that are missed at this point are going to be, you know, as many games as the owners want to see missed. I believe the players are going to continue to fight for the fair treatment that they believe they're entitled to. So it could be very interesting.
So players can't just show up and work out at the facility anyway?
That's right. They're literally locked out of the facility. They can't do it. They can't, you know, the league has instructed coaches not to communicate with players. So yeah, they're completely iced out. I mean, you know, one thing that would be very interesting would be to see if players went off and played somewhere else, you know, on college fields or high school fields or something, and brought fans out. I bet quite a lot of fans would like to see that, and might prove to the owners just who the lifeblood of the game really is. But I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But regardless, you know, the bottom line answer is no, they can't show up to the spring training facilities. They are literally locked out by the owners and have no choice in the matter.
With regards to the coaches, how does this impact them? Are they kind of in between both sides?
Yeah, I think it can be a bit of a difficult, yes, I think, you know, that can be a bit of a difficult situation for some coaches, obviously, who have close relationships with players and are in a position now where they can't communicate with them. So, you know, some of those coaches are actually former players themselves, but ultimately they are, you know, they're sort of on the management side of things at this point. And so that's how the lines are drawn. And that's kind of just the breakdown at this point. So players are very much on their own, fighting for together for what they believe in, fighting for a system that allows them to get paid what they're actually worth well earlier than sort of 13 years in, right? Because as I said, 7 years in the minor leagues, 7 year minor league contract where you're under team control, then 6 years of team control before you get to free agency, the major leagues. It's a system that is candidly broken from a player perspective. And unfortunately, I think the conversation has been anchored in a place that's very unfavorable to players. So if players ask for drastic changes to the system, the average person who's not steeped in the details of the way that the system works thinks, oh man, these players are being unreasonable. And they might look at a few highly compensated players who've made it through the 13 years and point to them and say something different. But, that's, I don't know. It's unfortunate because I think if people knew the whole system and the whole way that it works, they would be more on the side of the players. And I hope that continues.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I think it's just from the outside, everything looks perfect and you never really know what's going on and what folks are going through. So thank you so much for sharing all of this insight with us. We have about a minute or so here left. What other issues are you working on that you think folks should be aware of in this realm?
So as I mentioned, the year-round pay and spring training pay is a big issue for minor league players. We think that there's no excuse for players in a multi-multi-billion-dollar industry to be making $8,000 a year and working second and third jobs just to make ends meet. So I would encourage, fans of the game to educate their friends and family about this system that's in play in our national pastime and to hold teams accountable, whether it's by, social media, by, communicating directly with teams, by going.
And you're listening to All In, and we are going to thank everyone for joining us on our program today. Harry, there you are.
Sorry, did I cut out there for a sec?
Yeah, no worries.
Sorry about that. No, I was just, I don't know where I cut out, but I was just saying the year-round pay and the spring training pay, I think, are the biggest issues, and players need fan support. If the fans show teams that they care about those issues, then that's what's going to make ownership and the league pay attention. So that's where I'd like to see things go is year-round pay for players who are working a year-round job. Pretty simple.
Well, thank you so much. Harry Marino is the Executive Director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.